Welcome to the Geneva Peace Week podcast series, a project of the Geneva Peacebuilding Platform. Geneva Peace Week was founded on the core belief that each person, actor, and institution has a role to play in building peace and resolving conflict. Geneva Peace Week is an annual forum in the peacebuilding calendar that includes ceremonies, high-level panels, policy briefings, workshops, videos, podcasts, and other special events. These free contributions are hosted by different organizations and actors around the world. This year, Geneva Peace Week celebrates its 10th anniversary and is held from the 30th of October to the 3rd of November, 2023. For more content, join us at the Geneva Peace Week or online at www.genevapeaceweek.ch.
Hi, I'm Katerina Kramer, Head of Communications at Sigma European Think Tank.
And this is Cristiana Bădulescu, your co-host.
You're listening to episode 2 of our podcast series, Power and Polarization, Disinformation Against the Vulnerable.
Sigma European Think Tank published last year a report on understanding how disinformation targets women and other vulnerable groups, and it's available on our website.
Women, minorities, and youth are so-called vulnerable groups in the topic of disinformation, and I think vulnerable groups and scapegoating go hand in hand. Would you agree, Chris?
Scapegoating is selecting some person or persons to upon whom all the sins and problems of society can be blamed. So it's a way of liberating everyone else from the burden of guilt, of failure, of their own sins or whatnot. And there's a great quote from Eric Hoffer in his book, The True Believer. And he says this: "Hatred is the most accessible and comprehensive of all the unifying agents. Mass movements can arise and spread without belief in a God, but never without belief in a devil." And that's what the scapegoat serves as, that I think is very pertinent. And that is, it is a feature of right-wing populist and fascist movements to identify an other to be scapegoated. And this other group needs to be politically and financially weak enough that they can't really fight back. And so they have to find a group that's vulnerable enough that they can identify them and marginalize them and turn them into this devil against whom they can unite everyone. And what happens is the themes that get used in scapegoat, it doesn't matter if it was the disinformation messages against the Jews in Germany in the 11th century, the blood libel, you know, they're eating our children and drinking their blood, this disinformation. It doesn't matter who the group is. The same themes, the same narratives are used, and here's a few of them. One is they're not like us. Another one is that they're a threat to our way of life, and in particular, saying that a group is a danger to children, and even though there's no proof of any such thing. What the disinformation is trying to do here, it is relying on triggering the human instinct to protect children. In many of these ways that people are grouped and unified by against a scapegoat, it is by hacking their empathy and compassion for the rest of society. So people who are being cruel to a minority that has been targeted, they don't feel like they're being cruel. They feel like they have a lot of empathy and compassion because they think they're trying to protect the rest of their society. So this is where human compassion gets hacked. Or the other theme is always they're trying to take advantage of us. This is a hate narrative that's used to stir up resentment and animosity or to justify discrimination or violence against a group. So these basic themes are found in almost everywhere in human history and around the world to scapegoat a population through disinformation.
Perhaps to link that back to vulnerable groups, in what way do you think women, minorities, and youth are being specifically targeted by disinformation? And is there a way to overcome this?
Disinformation against women is the oldest form of disinformation there is. And you go back and look at how what we live with today, going as far back as Mary Magdala being called a prostitute when she was nothing but another apostle of Jesus Christ at that time. So I think women are often a target, or usually a target, because in most of the world, women don't have the equality, don't have the political and economic power. In the places where that's changing, though, that is where you see other groups being targeted. So, you know, when women become the tigers, or any population gains power, they are less likely to be a target of it. I think the important thing about overcoming the disinformation against them is, again, remember, if the far-right authoritarian movement needs a devil, needs a scapegoat, then I think one of the most simple things we could do is deny them their devil. We don't let people get pushed out to the margins of society. We hold them close to us. We bring them into our society. We bring them into our civil society organizations. We elect them to public office. We make them part of society. We reinforce their humanity. And by doing that, we deny them their scapegoat. I think that's a huge one.
Max, as you work for Voraus, which is a think tank mainly composed of young professionals, perhaps you can tell us a bit of how Voraus tries to combat this and how do you see the youth changing?
I think that the key word that we are looking at is empowerment, that we give these marginalized groups, and in my case, it's young people, that we give them a social and also a political dimension that they can become active in, and that we ensure that these marginalized groups are included in the development of policies, that they are included in initiatives to actually counter disinformation, and that we bring them into the process of actually having their voice heard and hearing their experiences, their perspectives, because this is what needs to be considered in decision-making processes. So, and only through this, we can then fight back and against the disinformation and the fake news, which in turn present them as a vulnerable scapegoat.
Something that I would like to emphasize is that we should not assume that young people are less prone to disinformation and fake news just because they are younger and possibly more digitally literate. We should really conduct an assessment of what digital literacy really means for various groups of people, because at times it may only mean that they use Facebook and WhatsApp and they are not able to go beyond. And echo chambers really do exist at all ages. So I really think that education is the best instrument for what empowering people, irrespective of, you know, one's age and social condition. And I think we are all exposed to disinformation. And children, interestingly, it turns out they are really the very ripe targets for fake news. I was reading a study published recently in the British Journal of Developmental Psychology that basically shows that age 14 is when kids often start believing in unproven conspirational ideas. And for children whose parents might believe conspiracy fantasies or other lies fueled by disinformation, school is the one place where they can be taught skills to evaluate such claims objectively. So we should start early. We should start from the elementary school with a training around disinformation, with conversations around disinformation. And such training should really go throughout one's educational path. So we start early, but we continue in secondary school, high school, higher education. So far in universities, courses around disinformation, conspiracy theories are lacking. There are some elements in courses linked to citizenship education. There you see some elements around disinformation that are being addressed. But of course, the depth of the conversation varies very, very much from higher education system to higher education system, for institution to institution. The encouraging part is that we see that at European level, decision makers are becoming more and more aware that they need to do something about disinformation, not only in terms of awareness, but really in guiding educational systems in addressing it. So, for instance, as part of the Digital Education Action Plan, the European Commission last year produced guidelines for teachers and educators on tackling disinformation and promoting digital literacy through education and training. So we have these guidelines by a group of experts commissioned by the European Commission that basically these guidelines are for teachers and for educators on how to lead a conversation with their students around disinformation. And just one last point on this, because I just don't want to be misunderstood. I really do not believe that the solution is to have specific courses on disinformation. I think it is important that we adopt, irrespective of the discipline and the subject being taught, we as trainers, as educators, as professors, we embed this discourse and this sort of critical thinking in the subject matter, and we address it in a student-centered learning way. Everybody should be exposed to this conversation.
Would that then mean a new course on critical thinking?
We have seen that in various periods of time, curricula, school curricula, has been used as a tool for ideologies and for political agendas. So I'm a bit cautious with this. I would just say that, you know, initial teacher training and continuous professional development for academic teaching staff and for teachers from elementary and secondary schools should have elements on how to discuss this information with students. And I think this is also the line of thinking that the European Commission, but also other actors, if I'm not wrong, also OECD, put forward. So it's like a sort of train the trainers, like give the tools to the people that are teaching in order to be able to have a conversation with their students as part of the various disciplines that are being taught. So it's not really like a standalone course on disinformation and debunking fake news. It's much more about critical thinking and, as I said, about citizenship education. But there might be a way ahead with a standalone course, but I'm not sure how that would work out for various reasons from a pedagogical standing. I would prefer this to be embedded in the learning and teaching offer of an institution.
Chris, is this something that you've maybe seen in your research as well, that people, while they want more education on this topic, that they're a bit hesitant because they don't want more state influence?
Yes and no. I think first it's necessary to unpackage one of the things that makes disinformation so difficult to address, and that is, you know, that facts won't save us. And that is that when people believe a disinformation narrative, especially in this environment where we're being pressured to make all these binary choices, is believing is belonging and belonging is believing. That people not only believe a certain kind of disinformation, but they find a community of like-minded people who also believe it. So this is where it becomes not only so embedded in their identity, but they are now part of a community, and they don't want to give up their identity or their community. And so this is one of the things that makes it so difficult. And I think this psychological process is called cognitive closure. So you're stressed, you have to make a quick decision and find your tribe who also came to the same conclusion. So you'll survive the saber-toothed tiger coming around the next tree. You know, our brain can't tell the difference between that and some disinformation. So I think in a broader sense, I think there's a role for the state and for institutions, because I think it is so much more than education. I think education, definitely important. I love the products that the EU has been putting out. To me, that's a good start. We need to find a way to reach people who are no longer in school, to reach more senior people who are well beyond the educational system. How do we work with them to help them learn how to navigate this new information environment? There is a role for government well beyond education. And I think if we can address those things in a holistic manner, I think we're going to reduce the ability of disinformation to disrupt our society.
We asked non-experts on the topic of disinformation how they felt disinformation could be tackled.
I wish people read more. I wish people had better critical thinking skills. I don't know where this is going to go. Yeah, it'd be nice if there was more regulation.
It would be super easy because we don't have any, in my country, we don't have any classes in the elementary school or in the high school either talking about what does it mean, disinformation. And I think if we would start it in the elementary school or in the high school, then it would be way much easier for people to understand what is the difference between real and misinformation.
I think it's like one of the basic things that you is needed to have. You need a society where it's necessary and it's a must to have like understanding towards each other. And this is how we can all together fight against disinformation, I think.
This concludes episode 2 of the podcast series Power and Polarization, Disinformation Against the Vulnerable, a series by Sigma European Think Tank. Stay tuned for the next episode.
You've been listening to the Geneva Peace Week podcast series. For more content like this, join us at the Geneva Peace Week or online at www.genevapeaceweek.ch.